Thanks very much to the Manhattan Institute and to Henry Olson for putting on this lovely lunch. Thanks to Larry Gordon and Jason for all they've taught me about welfare over the years. And Gordon said something nice about being able to get welfare stories into the New York Times. In part, it's because of a very special friend who's here, Jack Rosenthal, who was for many years the editor of the New York Times Magazine. And I can't think of another, editor of a national magazine who was as committed to poverty coverage over the years. And without him, this book probably wouldn't have been possible. The book is called American Dream. It takes its title from an obscure line in the first speech by Bill Clinton, in which he said, I think we all know that too many children grow up in this country without getting a shot at the American dream. And that's the canvas of the book. It starts with two competing and ultimately colliding events in October 1991. This is a little short. This is easier. In October 1991, Bill Clinton gave his first speech in which he promised to end welfare. And in October 1991, two women got off a bus in Milwaukee coming from Chicago to go on welfare. Their names were Angela Jobe and Jewel Reed. They had no idea that they were they came to get higher benefits. Their boyfriends had gone to jail in Chicago. They had lost their ability to cover the rent in Chicago. They came to Milwaukee because the differential between welfare and housing was more in their favor in Milwaukee. They could rent a place. They had no idea that they were moving to a place that would soon become the welfare capital of the world. So they were moving right into the center of the bullseye without, of course, knowing it. A few years later, an unlikely conservative idealist reformer moves into Milwaukee in a rambling old Mercedes Benz with a leaky roof, convinced he can make work programs work even in the heart of the ghetto where they had never worked before. And Jason Turner set foot in Wisconsin. It was never the same after that, including in Angie and Jewel's lives. They had recruited Angie and Jewel are cousins. They recruited a third cousin up to Milwaukee. So it's the three of them, three members of an extended family. After Jason came to Milwaukee and put in his new work rules in place, two of the three quickly left the roles and became steady full-time workers. One had been on welfare for 12 years, one had been on for 8. Neither of them had a high school degree, but they both very quickly navigated the transition, much more quickly than I would have ever expected them, perhaps even than Jason would have expected, into steady full-time work. The third I'll come back to in a minute. The woman I want to talk about the most is named Angie Jobe. She's the main character of the book I wrote. And I want to talk about her work experience in three ways, both what it meant to her, about what it provided for her economically, and then about what it did for her kids. Jason, as a conservative idealist, felt strongly that work would mean something to people, that it would bring dignity, honor, meaning into their lives. And I have to say that in Angie's case, a little less in Jules, but certainly in Angie's case, Jason was right. Angie became a nursing aide in a nursing home, bottom of the ladder job, very physically stressful job. One thing I hadn't realized is a true fact. Nursing aides get injured more often than coal miners. It's really dangerous work from all the lifting she does. And she loved it. It really did provide a kind of meaning to her. My favorite story about Angie occurs when she's with a frail, elderly, frightened woman, probably with Alzheimer's. Angie's African-American. The woman's white. Angie leans down to clean her one day, and the woman, very early in Angie's career as a nursing aide, snaps at her, "Get your hands off me, you know what." And on the street, that would have just, Angie would have pulled out her knife. And in the nursing home, Angie just laughed. Angie's 4'11", says, "Well, the you know what is doing it because you can't do it yourself, so you might as well let me." And it just brought out this empathy, and she sloughed it off and said, "Old people, they're not responsible for what they say." She bonded with her patients, and it brought out a creativity and an empathy and a humanity in her that I think other aspects of her experience or life hadn't. So, credit one to Jason and the book tries to put her experience in a larger context, and I think Jason largely proved right there. The second thing I'd like to talk about in terms of her experience is how much it paid. Not much. I got access to 12 years of her actual earnings and welfare records from the state. She released the records. So this is not just her memory of what she earned, but what her various employers recorded her having paid in to the system for unemployment insurance. And if you look at her last 5 years on welfare versus her first 3 years off welfare, she's up about $3,400 a year, counting once her welfare goes down and her earnings go up. When you net everything out, she's up or about 15%. So you say, well, yeah, gee, that's a start. But that doesn't count work expenses. And even a modest estimate of what it cost her to have a car and go to work wiped out at least half that. Plus, she lost health insurance. One thing I don't think I was prepared, even having been around welfare as much as I had, was how much material hardship people suffered. And Angie was a successful worker. She out-earned 85% of the people coming off the rolls in Wisconsin. She lost the lights 3 times in 3 years, ran out of food more times than I could count, more times than I could count in part because she never wanted to talk about it. But I would understand that it'd be 9 o'clock at night and somebody would be having a fight in the house, and then I'd realize part of it was that nobody had eaten. They hadn't had dinner that day. On her 33rd birthday, I went to see Angie in the nursing home. It was 5 o'clock in the afternoon. She hadn't eaten that day. But if you ask her, you know, she'd say, nobody going hungry in this house. She wouldn't want to talk about it. Jewel, the other successful worker, lost, both Angie and Jewel lost their health insurance. Jewel had bleeding ulcers and was hospitalized and had her wages garnished to pay off her hospital bill. And when I asked her about it, she said, well, doesn't everybody who works have their wages garnished? It was just, she was puzzled that I was surprised that she had lost her wages. She had such low expectations. I wrote the book for two reasons. One, to try to enlarge the community of people who would be interested in this, which, I mean, everyone in this room would already be interested in the subjects of welfare and poverty. I'm hoping, if possible, to expand that number of people, but also secondarily for people like us who are already interested in it. This is so many policy discussions in Washington right now are extremely ideological, and you know, few more than welfare, which gives rise to such ideological passions. I tried to write it in a way that both liberals and conservatives could consult a common record. It's fine for me if people come to different conclusions about what it means than I do. I tried to question my own. I was against the law when it passed. I tried to put my own biases aside and start with a clean slate. So as I give these little talks, I've tried to say something that would challenge both a conservative group and a liberal group. Last night I was before a more liberal audience, and somebody asked me, do I think the law worked in terms of putting people to work? And I said, absolutely, yes. There's no question it did, much better than I had understood. The thing I would like to say, I think, before a more conservative audience is, I think a lot of times we forget how materially hard these people's lives are. I was not prepared for how much hunger I saw, just how much physical, material suffering. Third point on the kids. Here's probably the biggest disappointment, Jason. I think you and others had had a hope that the mothers, by going to work, would be role models for their kids and put their lives on a new trajectory. I really found very little evidence of that, not just in the three families I followed, but in the broader welfare world. Clinton used to always tell this story about a woman named Lily Hardin, who he had met when he was governor of Arkansas, and he said he asked her what was the best thing about leaving welfare for work. You know, Clinton, he's really into the story. She looked me in the eye, and she said, now when my boy goes to school and they ask him, what does your mama do, he can give an answer. Well, between the time that Governor Clinton told that story and the time President Clinton repeated it, that kid had gone to jail for a shooting. And even, you know, his mother's successful entry into the workforce may have just meant that she wasn't around as much in his life. A similar set of circumstances play out in Angie and Jewel's kids' lives. At one point, Angie's teenage daughter wound up spending weekends with a prostitute, just because a prostitute was sort of a friend of a friend in the family, and would take her to have her nails done and goes clothes shopping. Her oldest son, Red, when I asked him who his role model was, he wasn't Angie, his mother, who was working, but it was his auntie's boyfriend, who was a drug dealer, because he had that dust, Red said, dust was money. And when he was asked to write an essay for his school, a school essay about places he would like to visit, he picked Las Vegas because prostitution was legal there, and Ken was making money through prostitution as well. The last point on what I found concerns the third woman, Opal. She turned out to be a drug addicted to crack cocaine, although I didn't know it when I met her. And she just had the most horrendous journey through the social services bureaucracy that I think you could imagine, certainly that I could imagine. She was at Milwaukee privatized the system, so there were five different private agencies, some for-profit, some non-for-profit, running the welfare system in Milwaukee. She was at three different ones over a course of 3 years, had six different caseworkers at three different agencies, none of whom ever figured out that she was on drugs, even though it was in her file, none of whom gave her a work assignment, even though it was a system supposed to be universal work, none of whom, never mind, you know, got her into a program that could help her deal with her addiction. They just mailed checks, just like the old AFD system. At one point, she was homeless and living in a crack house, and you know, the W-2 was sending the checks to the crack house. Had it happened at just one agency, I would have thought it was a quirk. But the head of the three agencies were Goodwill. The head of they withdrew from the program after paying $1 million fine, and the head of the program said, we were guilty of bumbling, not trickiness. That was his defense of the agency. The second was the Opportunities Industrialization Center, a black grassroots. Goodwill's a corporate blue chip of nonprofit. Opportunities Industrialization Center, an African American black nationalist grassroots group, the head of which was just convicted on federal corruption charges. The third was a for-profit company called Maximus, and they ran into all kinds of problems there, too, and ended up paying back $1 million to the state after misappropriating, misusing a bunch of money. So I thought on the ground the system was just in disarray. I have 60 seconds to say what I would do about all this. I'll make 2 points. I think we have to keep some sort of work-based safety net in place for working mothers like Angie. She now gets almost 50% of her income, even as a successful worker, through the child care, she did eventually get subsidized health insurance, especially through the Earned Income Tax Credit program. She has worked time and a half now for many years, and she just can't make enough on her own as an unskilled worker to keep the lights on. So we have to keep doing that. That's only a sustenance answer. I think the longer-term answer has to be found in the men. The biggest surprise of all to me was just how much yearning there was among the kids and their mothers for the fathers. The fatherhood agenda, I started to think more and more as I worked on the book, but it's because it was coming up from the kids. Angie told me, I asked Angie how she became a nursing aide. It's a long story that has to do with feeling guilty that she never took care of her alcoholic father as he was dying, and she saw him for the last time. She hadn't seen him in several years, and he died a few months later. And he was so infirm, and she hadn't known he was dying, and she felt so guilty she hadn't been connected to him at that time, that she goes into a nursing home and wants to care for other people as a sort of displaced caretaking experience. I mean, this is something she's telling me. Her daughter, Keisha, goes to a cross-town high school because it has a pre-law program, even though it's terrible for her asthma and it requires it. She's a bad student and it puts more pressure, more stress on her. The reason she wants to go to a high school with a pre-law program is because her dad's in jail and she wants to get her dad out of jail. There's 10 stories like that. Every character was yearning for their father and none of them had known their father. So whether it's economic support or the family marriage promotion, I think there's got to be common ground for the left and the right to do something to bring the men back in the home. Thank you.